Today's episode of Tim Blackett and Friends is brought to you by Grandview Drive, a collection of short fiction written by me, Tim Blackett. A book which Emily Austin says is compelling, moving, shocking, disturbing, and sharp. A violently great read that will zap you like a 4,000-pound defibrillator. The book is found anywhere books are sold in Canada, and coming up on April 4th, it will be available anywhere worldwide. Welcome to the show. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Chelsea Wakelin about her book, What Remains of Elsie Jane.
A one, two, three, four. Tim Blackett, baby, dabba doo, deep, deep, bop, bopba doo, ribbit, deep, deep, bop, dabba doo, bow, deep, baby, bop, bopba doo. Tim Blackett, baby, deep, deep, baby, deep, bop, bopba doo. Tim Blackett, baby, deep, 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 deep. Tim Blackett, baby, deep, 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 bop. Tim Blackett, baby, deep, tip, tip, tip. Tim Blackett, Tim Blackett, Tim Blackett and Friends.
I first picked up What Remains of Elsie Jane by Chelsea Wakelin because Emily Austin had a blurb on the cover. I had just asked Austin to blurb my own book, to which she agreed, but to which she also told me she wasn't sure if blurbs were even relevant anymore. She wondered if they might be a remnant of things past and that the publishing industry is just holding on to. I told her it was still a primary resource for me when choosing new books. In fact, I told her, I literally just bought What Remains of Elsie Jane because of her blurb. The blurb had said the book was poignant, laugh-out-loud funny, weird, and heartbreaking. This connection is interesting for me because the two authors' works still seem to occupy similar spaces in my brain. Not that their work is indistinguishable per se, but they are striking in their similarities. They both take young women as their subject, both spend much of their books inside the head of their protagonists, and both seem to write without fear. Wakelin's work, however, especially after the second read-through, is notable for her raw vulnerability, sometimes shockingly so. Unwilling to back away from hard truths or hard feelings, even when, if the character's thoughts were voiced out loud, they might be considered violent or even intrusive. The beauty of the book, and what makes it stand out in my mind, is that it is able to do all of this while making us laugh out loud and make us feel along with Elsie Jane as she spirals into the depths of despair and grief. We can see that Elsie is spiraling, yet we are more than willing to follow down this desperate hole, at least I was. The whole thing is a poignant, laugh-out-loud, funny, weird, and heartbreaking tale of one woman's trek through world-altering grief. I've recommended the book to so many people. Library patrons who are looking for something different or something funny but not sentimental. Female friends who said they haven't found themselves in a novel for a long time. Male friends who said they usually can't relate to female characters. Even a TikTok follower who asked for books about the grieving process. And it's a testament to the book that it is all of these things, that it was a good and even refreshing recommendation for all of these different people. Many of them have thanked me for pointing me to it. It's been called the Year of Magical Thinking for Weirdos, a story about the power of grief and the depths to which love and loss can mystify and embolden us, and a novel that captures a young mother falling apart and putting herself back together again. To me, it feels more like a woman allowing herself to feel the grief and sadness and mourning in spite of expectations, her own and society's, but then taking control of her own life and in the end, moving forward. When I heard Chelsea talking about it in terms of autofiction, I knew I had to have her on the show to chat about it. Chelsea Wakelin is a Canadian novelist. She and her siblings raised 5 goats once upon a time, and she also plays the glockenspiel. What Remains of Elsie Jane is her first novel. Chelsea Wakelin, welcome to Tim Blackett and Friends.
Thanks, Tim. That was a great intro. And thanks for mentioning my goat-raising history, because...
Well, I saw that.
Nothing informs my life and personality more.
I saw that in your author bio and I thought I had to include it. So
thank you. Yeah. No, I miss my goats.
Yeah.
I loved my goats. All I want is land again so that I can have goats again.
Yeah. So I wanted to start off in terms of autofiction. This has been a particular fascination for me over the past few years. And I wanted to ask you what you mean when you call it autofiction. Carl Nosgaard and Sheila Hedy, two of the autofiction heavyweights in my mind, both have very different ideas about what it means. Nosgaard says the Carl in his novel is the same Carl who is writing them. The things he says and feels are the things the real Carl says and feels. While Hedy claims that Sheila in her novels is a character fully separate from herself, even if they are based on the same person. Obviously, you've chosen to call the character Elsie Jane rather than after yourself, so it might be a step removed. But yeah.
It was actually supposed to be called What Remains of Chelsea Jane.
Oh.
And I, at the very last minute, changed the title. I don't know, just because I wanted that separation. And I kind of regret it a bit, actually, because like I think we were having lots of discussions, Russell and I, Russell Smith, my editor at Dunder, about like the auto fictional aspect. And when it was when they first acquired it, you know, there was a conversation about like, do you want this to be a memoir? Do you want us to use this? And I didn't, and I don't, because it's not a memoir. It really is fiction. And so I would agree with Sheila. The voice in the book is not me. It's a character. It's a one of I'd say probably an infinite number of voices that we all have. And if any one of those pieces of self were to write a book, I would say it would not encapsulate the me that is in my day-to-day life, you know?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting aspect of autofiction is that it seems everyone writing or writing within the genre has their own idea of what it means, and some people are very close to like almost memoir and only saying it's fiction to be able to, well, I don't know, like Nausgaard seems to be like this is actual memoir, but he just pitched it as a novel, I don't know. And then others, Ben Lerner or Sheila Hedy or whatever, they are actively making characters based on themselves or whatever. Like, I don't know. It just seems like everyone has a different level of truth or reality mixed in with the fiction, and I find that to be just very fascinating.
Yeah, like I don't know. Do you remember A Million Little Pieces, that James Frey? Like I think I imagine how that would have been received if it was presented or sold as autofiction rather than a memoir, especially knowing how much of it was fictionalized and embellished. And that is like what this book, What Remains of Elsie Jane, is, that embellished, like really imagined what if in this experience that I had acted this way instead, or gone in this direction, what would have happened next? And so it's taking those real life scenarios and kind of riffing on them, you know?
So when you set out to write the book, were you writing autofiction, or were you writing a novel, or were you trying to write a memoir, or like was there a plan when you set out for it, or what was that like?
Yeah, definitely wanted it to be a novel. Never considered writing a memoir. And it took 5, 6 years from the beginning when I started writing. And yeah, I was listening to your podcast with Sheila Hedy, and just having listening to her explain sort of her process, and really relating to how she described like not writing in a linear way, and just taking pieces and then not really being sure how they fit together, but putting them all together and playing with structure and playing with story. Like, how can I take all of these kind of what seem now 5, 7 years ago now, really disparate pieces, and putting them together in new ways that create a fresh narrative. So yeah, that's the fun part to me. Like, after you have enough that you can start to, you know, puzzle it together in different ways, and see what is emergent out of that play.
That's really interesting for me too, even her conversation and her saying all of that. Like for me, I think I said in that episode that like I write everything just straight through beginning to end.
That's amazing. Like, that is, I cannot, I wish that I wish I could do that.
Guess it depends, like everyone, like I wish I could just have pieces of something that I put together. Like that sounds fun and interesting to me. I just don't know how I would do it because I have everything sort of like sort of loosely laid out before I start, and then I just try to get to those corner pieces that I have in my brain. I don't know.
Yeah.
But was it scary putting this out into the world, being that it was such a personal novel? I mean, the protagonist does some pretty sporadic, and I don't know. She does seem to be out of control at times. Were you worried about people reading it, or were you, was it scary? No?
No, I wasn't. I mean, I do feel that separation between like me and Elsie Jane and how she conducts herself. And then there are pieces of truth in some of it, like the night, I would say kind of like the bottom of her experience when she's they have to call her friend has to call an ambulance. That happened. And that was, and I mean, it's just being human, and I have no shame about being human. And I've always loved books that explore the underbelly of the human experience, like in terms of behavior and thoughts and like those kind of things that are unsayable in day-to-day life.
It does seem that a lot of writers, I mean, we're probably all on the spectrum, but especially those who are inching toward the auto fiction, it does seem like same thing. I wrote an auto fictional novel. It's not published yet, but there's some really like personal and embarrassing things in there that are pretty much me. Again, same thing. I could never pitch it as a memoir because it's just not a memoir. But people ask me if I'm scared or my friend thought I would be embarrassed, especially about this one part. And I'm like, well, it is kind of, but also, yeah, there's that separation. I'm not really that character, even though I'm telling my own story through that. It seems writers in autofiction are able to sort of disassociate, even though.
Yeah. Congratulations on your award shortlisting. That's so
Oh,
exciting.
yeah. Yeah, I was pretty excited about that. They held the announcement for the shortlist at the library, and I had the day off, so I got to go sit and like
Oh, cool.
watch them announce my name. So that was it was fun. Even I'm very proud of the book, but I'm still surprised that people like it. I don't know. Do you feel that way about your work?
Yeah, I definitely I'm always I'm well I yeah I've kind of like forget about my book a lot because my daily life just is not in the publishing or writing world at all. And so I'm like, oh yeah, I wrote a book.
Have you always been a writer? Let's talk about origin stories. I guess that it's another one of my favorite topics, finding out what made
Yeah,
other writers.
I've always wanted to be a writer. I've always written. Well, in grade 8, I got kicked out of my English class and school. I got kicked out of school because I mouthed off my English teacher, and I was failing that class in English 8. I think I got 17% in that class. But it was because I just didn't like the teacher, and probably a bit of PDA, like pathological demand avoidance there. But then when I went to like my high school, I had this amazing writing and English teacher named Terrence Young, and he is an author. He's a novelist and poet, and his wife Patricia Young is a poet, a renowned poet, and he brought in like Patrick Lane and Lorna Crozier and who else, like Weisin Choi and so many local authors, like amazing local writers, authors, poets, novelists into our classroom to read. And we got to like do Q&As, and they critiqued our work. And so it was like spending high school it was just an immersion in this like, intensive writing workshop, because that was his world, and it was so amazing. And so I really wanted to go do writing. I had this like dream of going to Concordia and doing the write-in, like moving to Montreal and having this like bohemian amazing experience and getting an undergrad and MFA. And I never did that. I didn't do any of that because life kind of got in the way where. And I'm grateful that my life went the way that it did, but like my mom got sick, she got cancer, and so I ended up staying and doing her care. And then I had kids. I had a daughter like when I was 23. So I just went on a different path and then ended up pursuing like mental health. I have worked in mental health and substance use for 20 years now. So my life didn't take that path into the MFA route, and I was really so sad about it for such a long time. And then I was like, well, I can still write, and I still am writing, and why not just finish this novel and try and make it happen. And if it doesn't happen, it doesn't happen. That's okay too.
So how long did you spend working on the novel? Or sort of, I guess, when did you think, I'm going to sit down and write this, and then how long did it take?
Well, I started sort of the first whispers of what eventually became the book in 2016, like the first pieces of writing that would make it into the book in 2016. And in 2020, I had all of this writing that I'd done over the those 4 years, and I was like, hey, I'm gonna put it together, so I did. I put it all together and tried to like make something cohesive-ish out of it. And I worked with a developmental editor, a friend of mine, that gave me some really great feedback, and like had some beta readers, just friends that had MFAs read it and give feedback, and then looked for an agent and found an agent, and it all happened really fast. Like I started querying agents in like March of 2021, and I signed with Aaron like the next month, and then sold the book in August of that year.
Cool.
So it was pretty quick, but because I didn't take that more traditional route to publication of like submitting short stories to journals and really putting in that upstream work into kind of developing a name, like as I am completely unknown, and I don't have like those connections in the writing community that I would have otherwise had I been really involved for all those years. So I'm a bit regretful that I don't have that, because yeah, but I mean, I love my day job and my work in healthcare, and I'm happy that I have it because it does allow me to write. But I guess I do still kind of regret not going down the MFA.
Well, it is impressive that it's such a good book. You're talking about publishing short stories here and doing all this. I tried to do that, but it was like nobody. I have so many, like hundreds of rejections for stories that are in this book. The only story I got published was one because my friend was doing like a self-publish Journal of Saskatchewan Writers, so he invited me to. So there was one story in that, but it's just self-published. No one knows what it is. It's out of print now. And then I had one story, Baby Oh Baby, published after my book was already accepted, and it was the publisher or the editor at that magazine like reached out after because I had published the book. So I mean,
Really?
yeah.
So you kind of went down the same way as I did, like you just did it on your own and
Yeah, kind of. I had help because I went to the Sask Writers Guild conference and I ran into, well, Lisa Bird Wilson was presenting there. And she and I started chatting a little bit and we both found out that we both had books accepted with Kotto Books here in Saskatchewan. But then it went bankrupt before either of our books were actually published.
oh
She was much farther along in that process, so they kind of she was able to just sort of shift to her current publisher, one of the bigger, I forget which one it's with now, but anyway, through that conversation, she said, "You should send your book to Knightwood." They published my first book, and I was really happy with everything they did, all the publicity and the help and whatever else. So I sent it to them, saying, mentioning this, and then she actually contacted them to say, "You got to read this guy's work." So it's all thanks to her, kind of, but that one connection that I made through the guild is what did it, I think.
That's amazing.
They had one essay published in a local magazine here, but that was a long time, like 20, I don't know, 15 or something when I was still in uni. Just a short, like 300-word essay about why we go to university. I also submitted to a lot of agents. I can't remember, like fewer agents than small publishers. I was more trying to get the book into a small publisher for years. And I submitted here and there to agents, but that process felt really overwhelming for me. I tried to do research what they're publishing and if they'd like my book, but I didn't know. So how did you go about that? Did you have agents in mind or did you?
Yeah, I did, but I ended up, the agent that I ended up signing with was not one of them that I had in mind. Like, and I did was querying throughout North America. But the one agent that I wanted was in Canada and is a really she was oh, that's my dream agent. And but then actually when I submitted to one agency, the owner of the agency was like, oh, this sounds like something Erin would like. And she responded right away and was like, this sounds like it's up Erin's alley. I'm going to forward it to her. And she was a newer agent, had only been at it for 2 years, but she is an editor at Food and Wine magazine and has she's a writer herself and really just an amazing, amazing human being. And she did like it and offered rep. So that was, I know lots of people spend years in the query trenches. And for me, it really was just right place, right, landed on the right desk at the right mm-hmm. moment when that person was, feeling magnanimous enough to pass it on to their
yeah.
New agent. So
it really is interesting and kind of frustrating how often it is just the lucky connections you make before something actually happens. But I mean, I'm glad to have it happen, but it was a long time of just feeling like I was alone here doing all this stuff. But yeah.
Yeah.
And so you published with, for some reason I thought it was Book Hug Press, but it's
Dundurn.
Dundurn.
Rare Machines.
Oh, great, yeah, great, great. Dundurn.
The second or third year of the Rare Machines imprint at Dundurn.
All right. A little more about the book. One thing I was taken with was early in the book when Elsie says that the stages of grief kind of all blend together, that they don't actually come as neatly as they're, laid out in the pamphlets or whatever. And I think you can really see that throughout the book, that there's all these different things happening as she's moving through the story. But I also found the novel was kind of formatted in stages. I hope this will make sense to you, but it seems like we begin the novel with Elsie sort of trying to figure out what happened, but being surprised by the autopsy and things like that, and then trying to forget all of it in a way with Saul and stuff. But then it moves past her into obsessing about the woman who was murdered. And then even the final stage, I thought, was trying to jump through time to save her husband, which I just thought was so, it seems strange to call this book funny, but it really is funny, even though it's dealing with such heavy, heavy themes. So anyway, I don't know if those stages, they don't really match up with the stages of grief or anything like that. But the novel is different than many novels in that there's a lot going on, even though it's not all going on at once, but in these sort of, to me, it feels like four stages, even though it's not four parts or anything. But these two seem to blur together in a way, one being the catalyst for the next and all that. I don't know if you have thoughts about that, or I know we talked about piecing things together, but did you have an outline like this, or were you purposely formatting it in this unique way, or was just how did the story come out?
I didn't have an outline at all. I had a very general idea, sort of a shape in my mind of how I wanted it to feel and look in terms of the structure. But no, I definitely did not. I gave it lots of thought around, especially when I was working with the developmental editor, who is Jill Margot at Good. We played around with the structure quite a bit, moving things around. And the space-time jumping thing, when I had initially beta readers read it, it was really controversial. Some people really hated it. They were I loved it up until this point. And then I hated it. They hated the sort of sci-fi element of like what is going on, like why is this, why does she suddenly believe that she can jump through space time, like, you know, this is hokey, or this is, you know, I just can't suspend my disbelief for this. And then some people were like, I fucking love this, this is so great, like, and so I just ended up like kind of just having to, and even Russell, my editor, was like, you know, I don't love this, but we'll but we'll keep it if you feel strongly about it. And I'm like, I do feel strongly about it.
I really loved that part. I just thought it was, well, yeah, on one hand it's totally unexpected, but then there it is, and it seems like almost a natural progression for Elsie Jane to start believing this and the unidentified body and everything, like it fits. Like I started thinking, like, oh, is this she really gonna go save her husband? But
Well, I like kind of put those pieces together, like around the dead body and the like the murdered woman in behind the movie theater, and the wizard, and her coming to this conclusion that it's probably, you know, it's obviously her body that when I was running, so I don't run right now, but I was running lots at the time during COVID, like every day going for long runs. And that was the time when I would piece it together in my mind, and before it became like the resurgence of the Kate Bush song Running Up That Hill, like made its big comeback on TikTok. That was the song that I was listening to as I was thinking about how to piece those two things together and how to make it work. Was like, you know, if I could make a deal with God and get them to swap our places, and thinking about like that dead body and her coming to that conclusion. That was kind of the impetus.
Yeah, it was very fascinating for me. And then the part I loved, maybe the best part of the book, is when she's arguing with the deer and the mother deer and her doe or whatever it is. Just the idea of that, the way she was sort of projecting her own judgmental thoughts about herself onto the deer, but then arguing through it and then getting to the end and like making a decision to move on. I don't know. I loved that part.
Thank you. I'm glad you liked that part, because it was gonna, that was like that ending. I wrote that whole last chapter after it had already been acquired by Dunder, and because my editor was like, okay, you can't end it here, it's too bleak, it's too depressing, because it originally ended with her just sitting in her yard, like looking at the tree and just very ambiguously about whether or not she would end up meeting the space-time wizard behind the movie theater, or whether, you know, and I wanted to keep it ambiguous. But my editor was like, no, we need to see a bit more here, and we need to see her kind of complete her arc. And in order to do that, you need to write more.
I think it works. I think it works really well. So, speaking of the book as being funny, it was hilarious. There were times, like, there's not very often books that make me laugh out loud, but this book in several spots made me laugh out loud, but it also made me feel a little bit bad because maybe these weren't appropriate things to laugh at. For instance, I was trying to explain to my partner, she's like, what are you laughing at? So I'm trying to tell her about how Ada Mae was turning into a suitcase.
Oh, yeah.
But he said maybe they could just carry her around like a suitcase. And it was Elsie Jane saying to herself that she felt capable of writing a rational and reasonable email back to her brother, whoever it was. And then that's the email she sent. So it was just, I don't know. I guess I'm wondering, is this just a natural part of your writing, or did you feel like there needed to be some comic relief, or like, how does this, like, I try to be funny, sort of, but I don't think I can be that funny in a book so far.
Well, I am naturally hilarious, so no, I definitely need some levity, I think. Although now that you mentioned the suitcase like grandma thing, my family did not like that at all. Especially since like the character Elsie Jane, like my grandmother's name is Elsie or was Elsie, and
Okay.
that part of the book is based on like is part of is real around like grandma getting one thing slowly amputated after another with Alzheimer's. And I mean, I'm already kind of estranged from my mom's side of the family, but now I'm definitely estranged. Like my cousin,
Yeah.
one of my cousins out east was like very excited when he heard about the book, and he posted and like tagged me on Facebook and was like, so excited to read my cousin's first novel. And then I guess he read it because he blocked me
That's terrible.
after reading it, which I'm just kind of like, oh, like I guess I should have put a trigger warning. Oh well.
I guess that's what I mean about feeling like it's not appropriate to laugh at, but it just was hilarious. It caught me by surprise, I think.
Well, it is. I mean, those that's just like it's so morbid that how can you not? I mean, you have to laugh at that level of morbidity.
And then to have my partner there beside me, like witnessing me laughing and having to explain. It just made it even more funny. I don't But I really like what Liz Harmer says in her blurb on the book. She says that Elsie is relentlessly hopeful without being cheerful, loving without being good. And I feel like this is very apt, the way the book actually does feel hopeful, at least as it's wrapping up. But even throughout it, it's kind of amazing considering the sort of vast amounts of loss the character has endured. Did you feel like this was a hopeful story as you were writing it, or how were you able to pull that off? Did you feel like you were pulling it off as you were writing? I guess we sort of chatted about it with the editor, but.
Yeah, I don't know if I felt like I pulled it off. I begrudgingly added that hopeful last chapter because I wanted to leave it ambiguous at the ending because that's what grief is really like. It doesn't just end in some sort of, you know, there isn't an epiphany necessarily after a year or any arbitrary amount of time. And so that was my rationale for keeping the ending ambiguous. But I think given the, and I think Russell, my editor, was right, like that given the kind of weight of the rest of the book, it needed some kind of resolution. And I'm really happy that I did end up giving her some hope at the end and giving her sort of not necessarily like resolution, but at least, you know, clearing the way for her to take a next step in her life. Because for me, and that was also part of separating that story from myself and my story, even though of course I did not think that I could contact a wizard and jump through space time, but like in terms of like my grieving process when my spouse died of drug poisoning, that it just went on and on. Like it went on for years, and that's why I was so focused on this project for years, because I wanted to write something as a tribute to him and that relationship, and have at least something come out of that experience, and wanted to make art from that shitty, you know, half decade
Yeah.
of life. So
To me, the end doesn't, like, in terms of resolution, it doesn't feel like it's like all tied up in a happy little bow and now life is going on as perfect after the end of the book. Like, it feels like it's just sort of she's beginning to make a decision to like move forward, sort of. So it's just, to me, it feels like first steps. And then, like, I feel hopeful because once the book ends, I get to create what happens after. And to me, she seems like she's on at least a hopeful path. So, and I like that in a, I like that in a book. It reminds me of short stories, the how short stories often end ambiguously, but the reader gets to figure out what happens next. And so sometimes you can think, oh, that's shitty because this is going to happen and that's horrible. But other times you can think, what a great ending because this will probably happen and that's really cool. That's how I feel about
I
this.
actually like, I have so much trouble with, I love short stories, but I have a lot of trouble with short stories because I, you know, I get it really attached and I don't want it to end. And I'm like, all of these short stories should be a novel. I want to live in this person's world for longer than, yeah.
I feel that way sometimes too, but I just love the short story form so much that I've accepted that. sometimes you can do things in short stories that you can't in a novel. And if all of my favorite stories were stretched into novels, I feel like they'd be sort of boring, but not all of them, but you know.
Yeah.
So I think it's time now for the penultimate segment. This is a segment I like to do with each guest that is specific to them. So I talk about something that, for whatever reason, I know is specific to that guest. With Jessica Johns last time, it was talking about her puzzles and how she likes to punch the puzzles when she's done making them. And here I thought we would talk about some of the music that occurs in the book. Both Elsie Jane and Sam talk about the music that they're listening to in emails to each other, and even just throughout the narration, when Elsie Jane hears songs, she talks about them. So every time I came across a song in the book, I downloaded it and I added it to a playlist called Elsie Jane, and then I started listening to it towards the end of the book once there was, I think there's 15 or 16 songs. So for the penultimate segment, I am going to play snippets of four or five songs, and I can only play up to 6 seconds before I get in trouble with copyright. So I'm going to ask you to try to identify which of these songs. See if you can tell me what the song is with 6 seconds of a song. And they're all coming from the Elsie Jane playlist.
I feel like I'm on like a radio, you know, one of the, they do this on the radio sometimes.
it's a really
Everybody has to call in.
it's a really fun game show. You get 6 seconds to tell me what this song is.
It's Elton John.
Yeah, do you know
Rocket
that? Rocket Man, you got it.
Man.
This, maybe it's too easy. They're your songs after all. How about this one? I've come this far and I know I can make it.
Yeah. Broken heart, and you can't break a broken heart. Yeah, that's Daniel Johnston. Can't remember the name of the song for some reason. I think it's True Love Will Find You in the End, right?
This one's called Silly Love.
Oh, Silly Love. Yes.
All right. Moving on to number three. Let's try this one.
I was dancing when I was 12. I was dancing when I was 12.
As T-Rex.
You got it.
God, I'm so bad with song names. I should know this. Cosmic Dancer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're two and a half out of three so far. All right, here's number four.
Downtown Train, Tom Waits.
You got it. You talked about that song twice. Well, one was the shitty version by Rod Stewart. I downloaded both of them. All right, last one, and then I think I have one bonus one.
Starfish on the Toast by Donovan.
You got it. 4.5 out of 5. Some of these songs I had heard of, but quite a few of them I hadn't heard of. My buddy has been trying to get me to listen to Tom Waits for a long time, and I just haven't, but I think I might dip into his work after listening to a few of these songs. And then the Okkervil River song I really loved.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Joni Mitchell, of course. There's a couple of those. That was a fun little thing for me. I like playlists for
Yeah,
books.
me too. I love that you did that. That's so great. Have you ever seen what's it called? There's like a blog that something boy, I can't remember, but there's a book blog that he does playlists for
Oh,
debut
really?
books.
Cool. I'll have to try to find that. That
I'll
sounds
look at,
interesting.
I'll find it and I'll send you the link.
That's cool. Yeah, music. I always listen to music while I'm reading, unless I'm lately I've been listening to the audiobook while I'm reading so I can read really fast. But yeah, so a long time ago, probably 20 years ago now, I was reading C.S. Lewis's Space Trilogy. Not everyone knows about that, you know.
I
He
don't know
he wrote Chronicles of Narnia, but then he wrote some adult fantasy, and there's the Space Trilogy, and I can barely remember what happens in it. But for whatever reason, while I was reading that, all three books, I was listening to a Franz Ferdinand album on repeat through that whole time. And so now, anytime Franz Ferdinand comes on, I'm like immediately back in space with C.S. Lewis. It's kind of wild. All right, here is the bonus question. We'll see if you can get this one. This one is sort of a cheat. Here we go.
Oh my God.
What do you think?
That is a When Will I Be Loved by the Lonesome Valley Singers.
Awesome. And
Oh, that's hilarious.
you played in that band?
Yeah, that's me singing.
Well, that's you singing. Wow.
Yeah.
Cool. That's only from your bio at the back that you played glockenspiel in the band or
Yes, I
something.
was also on the
Cool.
Glock in that recording. Yeah. Lonesome Valley Singers was a death country band.
Awesome. When I looked them up, there's quite a few albums recently that seems to be from a different band, or maybe just.
Yeah, so that's my ex-husband, actually, my daughter's dad,
Oh.
David Chenery. So I want to give a shout out to David Chenery. He's amazing. He's the most prolific songwriter I've ever met. And he is a genius, and everyone should go check out his music because he is a genius songwriter. Yeah.
They're still called the Lonesome Valley Singers.
No, that is one of the old
Oh.
bands. What is it? What does he play under now? I don't remember.
Ah.
I should know this, but I don't know it off the top of my head. I think there was Black Valley Gospel. I think he might still play under Black Valley Gospel.
Well, that was fun for me finding new music, and I'm glad that you were able to get them all. That was fun.
Yeah, yay.
All right, we'll move on to the final segment. This is my friends off or friends on segment. This is based on a thing I was doing in the summer with TikTok, in which I'd list some books and say these are friends off. If this is your favorite, we can't be friends. So, what do you think? Do you have any friends off books?
Not really. Like, I think my only friends off books would, because I can forgive in my friends, poor taste in fiction. Like, we don't have to talk about books. We don't have to talk about your poor taste in fiction. If I see that somebody likes Colleen Hoover or, Sarah J. Maas, sorry folks, but I can forgive it and just be like, you just don't have good taste. But
But
I love you anyway. But if somebody's like, I love Atlas Shrugged or like 12 Rules for Life, then that's an friends off.
yeah.
Sorry, you cannot be in my world.
Yeah, those both made it on my list too.
Yeah.
But even those, I think, like in the end, it was just a bit for TikTok. And I've never actually said to anyone, well,
No, me neither.
we're not friends. But maybe if I like was just being introduced to someone and we got on two books and that's what they said, then I'd probably not want to, I wouldn't make an effort to go hang out with them again type thing. But
Yeah, I mean, maybe I would ask some probing questions about like their thoughts about it, because maybe they're
yeah.
researching, like maybe they have the book because for school or for yeah. I mean, there's all kinds of reasons. So if it would definitely like make me have some assumptions that might need to be investigated.
It is a fun bit though. I still
That is a fun
I
bit.
like thinking about it.
Yeah.
All right, and finally, your friends on books. These are just books that you have loved historically, maybe some of your favorites, or books that you've read recently that you really loved and you want to talk about, whatever books that you love.
Yeah, so I just grabbed some books from my bookshelf that I love randomly. So these aren't like in any sort of order or like, but I've got Fake It So Real by Susan Sanford Blades, which is set in Victoria in my hometown. And this book is fa fabulous. It's about like this punk rock couple in the early 80s and then follows their two daughters through their childhood and youth and adulthood, and it's a fantastic book.
Sounds
Fake It So
interesting.
Real. I've got of course Interesting Facts About Space.
Awesome.
I love this book and I love it. And I can't imagine not slobbering over anything that Emily writes.
Yeah, have you
I've
read her
got
poems?
I haven't yet. I want to get the
Yeah.
Gay Girl. What is her new
I think it's called Gay Girl Poems.
Gay Girl Poems. Yeah, I want to get
Yeah.
that.
Yeah.
Okay, so I've got Doppelganger, Naomi Klein, just came out. Loved this book. I listened to it on audiobook twice, and I've read it, and I love it. And especially great for just kind of like, yeah, I think it's like the first really important post-COVID nonfiction book. Like, I just think
Interesting.
I love it. I grabbed this one because I just love Samantha Irby and I love her sense of humor and I love her writing. And I read this one while I was writing What Remains of Elsie Jane. And yeah, just
That's
all the books that I read while I was writing it, like have, I don't know if you feel this way, but like just I feel like have a special place in my heart.
What's the title of that?
Oh, We Are Never Meeting in Real Life by Samantha Irby. Sorry, I forgot that people can't see, but yes, We Are Never re Meeting in Real Life essays. I love all her work, but this is just the one that I grabbed. I've got Stories of Raymond Carver, because this is like, you can see it's so beat up. People can't see it, but this beat book has the shit beaten out of it because I've read it so many times and I've taken it so many places. And I actually stole this book from my friend Jay McLaughlin. I'm sorry, Jay, I'm never getting it back. And I've got Flowers for Algernon. I think I read this for the first time when I was 10 or 11 during a family vacation to Watch Lake. In Shuswap near 100 Mile House, and we were in a cabin with no electricity, and there was this great thrift store down the road, and I got a copy of Flowers for Algernon, and I just loved it so much.
I have never read that one, except for I literally just picked it up from the library like 2 days ago, so
No way.
it's on my list. Yeah,
It's an easy
I've heard
read.
people
I've
talking
probably
about
read
it.
it like 10 times. I
Yeah.
just love it. And there it kind of like if you have you ever read Ted Chiang?
I've just a couple of his stories, but he's on my list too. Like he's moving up the priority list here.
So he's my favorite short story writer. I love his work. But one of his short stories, and I can't remember the name of it, I wish I could, is very like reminiscent of Flowers for Algernon. But more of a sci-fi
Yeah.
speculative element. Okay, I've only got two more. I'm sorry. I just grabbed
Sure.
like a big pile. I've got Pacifique by Sarah L. Teggart. So this is also set in Victoria, or what is colonially known as Victoria. And it is fabulous. It's like a psychological thriller, but it's also an exploration of mental health and incarceration in the mental health system, and the fact that it's set in Victoria in a building that I actually worked in, like and it's so beautifully written, and I loved this book. I've read it twice in the last since it came out. And last one is that I grabbed because I had to have some poetry, and I grabbed Exculpatory Lilies by Susan Musgrave. And this is just because it's a grief book. This is a book full of grief poems that is just drenched in agony, and so beautiful. And so I don't know. I feel like this book. I bought three copies and gave them out as gifts. Because I just they're so human, and she just captures that loss so well. Those are
Cool.
them. Those are my 1, 2, 3, 4, my 8 recommendations randomly grabbed from my bookshelf.
Thank you so much for adding to my TBR. Well, I guess that's it for our conversation. Thank you so much, Chelsea Wakelin, for joining me on Tim Blackett and Friends. It was a lot of fun, and I hope it was for you too.
It was super fun. This was like number one fun time podcast ever because we got to do the music thing and then we also got to talk about books. So thanks.
There we have it. Episode 4 is in the bag. See you next time. A one, a one, a one, two, three, four. Tim Blackett, baby, dabba doo, deep, deep, bop, bop, doo, ribby, deep, deep, bop, dabba, doo, bop, deep, deep, bop, bop, doo. Tim Blackett, baby, deep, deep, bibby, deep, bop, bop, doo. Tim Blackett, baby, deep, deep, bibby, deep, deep. Tim Blackett, baby, deep, 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 bop. Tim Blackett, baby, deep, tip, tip, tip. Tim Blackett, Tim Blackett, Tim Blackett, and friends.